Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Wednesday, June 9th. Many things are different in the Biden administration than they were under Donald Trump, right? We could spend the next hour counting the ways. Let's not minimize that. But some things are not that different. A Washington Post column by Ruth Marcus today says, quote, rather astonishingly, the Biden Justice Department is continuing the Trump administration's efforts to shield the former president from a defamation suit filed by author E. Jean Carroll, who says that Trump sexually assaulted her in the 1990s and then slandered her when she went public with her claim in 2019. The column notes that Attorney General Merrick Garland is also appealing a federal judge's order to release a full version of a memo about the Mueller report from the Trump administration. And Garland is arguing to dismiss a lawsuit against Trump and former Attorney General William Barr for violating protesters' civil rights during the violent clearing of Lafayette Square last year. That from the Washington Post on the Justice Department. Then there was this headline in Forbes on June 1st. When it comes to weapons, the Biden administration's budget is just like Trump's. We'll explore that on another day. But Vice President Kamala Harris returned last night from a two-day trip to Mexico and Guatemala, facing criticism from some in her own party, because while in Guatemala, maybe kinda, sorta, like Trump would have done, she said this.
I want to be clear to folks in this region who are thinking about making that dangerous trek to the United States-Mexico border, do not come. Do not come. The United States will continue to enforce our laws and secure our border.
That statement drew reactions like this tweet from New York City Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She wrote, first, seeking asylum at any U.S. border is a 100% legal method of arrival. Second, the U.S. spent decades contributing to regime change and destabilization in Latin America. We can't help set someone's house on fire and then blame them for fleeing, unquote, from AOC, from, of course, the political sector, from the media commentary space. Maria Hinojosa, who many of you know, host of Latino USA, tweeted, I just saw that the Veep told refugees today, do not come. Honestly, I'm just going to tell you, I'm heartbroken. For a woman, daughter of immigrants, to say this to people who are desperate is just heartbreaking. Kamala Harris is, of course, a woman, daughter of immigrants. Maria continues, stay and be killed by your lover. Stay and be killed by the gangs. And Maria's tweet ended with a sad emoji face. We should say that the vice president didn't make up this policy. Her boss did. Here's President Biden himself on ABC News in March.
I can say quite clearly, don't come. And what we're in the process of getting set up, and it's not going to take a whole long time, is to be able to apply for asylum in place. So don't leave your town or city or community. We're going to make sure we have facilities in those cities and towns run by DHS and also access with HHS, the Health and Human Services, to say you can apply for asylum from where you are right now.
President Biden on ABC in March there telling Central Americans, as Trump did, do not come. Here's more of what the vice president said in Guatemala on Monday.
Most people don't want to leave home. They don't want to leave the place where they grew up, where the language they know is spoken, where their culture that they know is present and has been, in this case, for centuries. Most people don't want to leave where their grandmother lives. And when they do, it is usually for one of two reasons. Because they are fleeing some type of harm, or because to stay means that they cannot provide for their essential needs and the needs of their family.
On the fleeing some type of harm side of that, there is anti-democratic government as one example, and as Harris says, she conveyed to Guatemala's president.
We did have a very frank conversation about the importance of an independent judiciary. We had a conversation about the importance of a strong civil society.
And on NBC News, when Lester Holt pressed Harris about why she was going to Guatemala, but not to the southern border of the U.S., Harris stated clearly how their administration is different from Trump's.
I'm in Guatemala because my focus is dealing with the root causes of migration. There may be some who think that that is not important, but it is my firm belief that if we care about what's happening at the border, we better care about the root causes and address them. And so that's what I'm doing.
So that's what we're doing. Let's talk about root causes of why the U.S. southern border has more migrants seeking asylum than many in the U.S. believe we can comfortably handle, and what's in the humanitarian interest of the people there and their families here. With me for this is Anita Isaacs, professor of political science at Haverford College and the director of Migration Encounters, a Mexican Migrants Oral History Project. She studies democracy, democratization, and democratic transitions with a focus on peace building in Latin America and particularly in Ecuador and Guatemala. And she has a New York Times op-ed this week called Guatemala is America's Best Chance to Fix the Immigration Problem. I'll say she co-wrote the piece with Jorge Morales Toj, a leader of the Maya K'iche people of Guatemala. He's a human rights lawyer and specialist in rural development, but he doesn't speak English, so she is representing them both. Thanks for joining us, Professor Isaacs. Welcome to WNYC.
Thanks so much for having me.
One of your main arguments in your op-ed is not to treat all the countries of Central America the same. A survey done in Guatemala, you point out, had more people saying economic reasons and fewer citing fear of violence compared to neighboring countries from which many migrants are also coming. Can you expand on what specific economics make Guatemala unique?
What's different about Guatemala, and particularly the indigenous highlands of Guatemala, is that there is not an absence of violence, but there is relatively less of the kind of violence that drives migration from El Salvador and from Honduras, and the violence that drives migration from the non-indigenous parts of Guatemala. In the indigenous highlands, there the challenges are acute poverty and despair combined with frustration and a desire to dig oneself out of that economic despair and to build an economic future. It's not that Guatemala is entirely different from the rest of the region, is what I was trying to say, but rather that in contrast to other countries and in specifically focusing on the indigenous rural highlands of Guatemala, the vast, vast majority of people who are trying to come to the United States are coming driven by economic despair and by the hope for economic opportunity that they can't achieve back home.
And one of the really interesting things, at least to my eye, that you wrote was that those migrants aren't seeking the American dream, as we think about immigrants to this country often. They're seeking the Guatemalan dream, but they need to go to the United States to attain it. Why does the path to a better life there run through here?
Okay. This is actually sort of not my rhetoric. These are the words, I would say, of Guatemalans in rural communities that I've spoken to over the past several decades, and that Jorge Morales, my co-author, Toch, has also spoken to. So it's their own words that I'm reporting here. I'm not using just a turn of phrase here. Mm-hmm. And I've often, they talk about the American dream and they say, no, this is a Guatemalan dream or a Mayan dream that we're after. The reason why they can't achieve it at home, because they are living in a profoundly unequal and racist society in which the governments have historically shown complete indifference to the majority of their population who are indigenous Guatemalans and who live in sort of conditions of poverty and complete neglect. And they also are confronting a government who has historically aligned itself with a very, very tiny elite who is sort of equally intent on maintaining a sort of rigged status quo that advances their very narrow economic interests. So they have absolutely no opportunities at home to actually pursue their own dreams for a better life. Their dream is the same as our dreams, the same American dream. It's not, we don't have a monopoly on this notion of sort of making a better life for ourselves and our children. That's what Guatemalans want too.
And so you refer to the Guatemalan Civil War, which ended 25 years ago. But you remind us in the article, as you just did in that last answer, that the country is still divided sharply along racial and class lines. By the way, our civil war ended 150 years ago, but we're still sharply divided along race. But that, you know, they come here and join that context, but I guess it's still better for them than in Guatemala.
It's impossible. In Guatemala. It's absolutely impossible. You only have to travel out to rural Guatemala to witness sort of within a second the total neglect. I am sort of a vision that I have in my mind is sort of a tourist trip to a small coffee estate that's been made into a kind of playground about an hour outside of Guatemala City, and being in this sort of zip line on with friends on this in this sort of playground estate, and seeing the Guatemalan indigenous peasants, farmers, carrying still wood that they had to chop down for firewood on their backs, walking along the zip line. This is a country where the inequalities are so sharp that they don't just stare you at the face, they knock you off your feet.
On coming here for the Guatemalan dream running through this country, your article refers to slow-motion construction of multi-story homes in Guatemala and a growing fleet of cars and pickup trucks there. This is from remittances to family members there rather than people earning money here and then moving back?
Yeah, it's predominantly from remittances that are being sent back. They're financing sort of the construction of homes. It's that look very much like often like replica of U.S. homes. They sometimes even have white picket fences. They have driveways sometimes. They have cars increasingly parked outside. And it's almost impossible to set up a business, which is some of what sort of I encourage as part of a development strategy in Guatemala. When they want to set something up economically, it often ends up being sort of just one more little bodega or convenience store.
But opponents of offering asylum in large numbers would argue that makes Guatemalan immigration more about a positive desire to do better for themselves and their loved ones, which would be so-called normal immigration. So, okay, get in line and apply, they would say, rather than the oppression we might classically associate with what political asylum is for. What's your take on that?
Okay, a few things. I think that the article tried, I've written a lot about, sort of almost continuously, about the unraveling of democracy and the widespread corruption and crackdowns on justice operators and civil society in Guatemala. And that's of enormous, enormous concern. And unless the U.S. plays, really takes this into account and calibrates how it wants to do business with the Guatemalan elite and the Guatemalan government, then we're also going to witness a surge in political refugees from Guatemala. Not just people fleeing gangs, because there are some, they're not predominantly from the indigenous highlands, but there will be a rise in political refugees if we allow the Guatemalan government to get away and to continue down the path it started down a few years ago and has accelerated over the past few years. So I just want to be clear about that. The article was trying to do something a little different this time and emphasize that for the time being, so many Guatemalans are fleeing their country driven by economic despair that there are policies, there are initiatives that we can pursue if we want to get bang for the buck in addressing the root causes of migration by investing heavily in rural development, in generating real rural development opportunities, mm-hmm. ones that are effective and ones that target communities in the ways that communities need it. So that's, I was threading a little bit of a needle in this piece, but I mm-hmm. was sort of focusing on a target of opportunity without neglecting the real, real concerns for what the government is doing politically at the moment.
I understand. And you list some particular investments that you think our country could make in their country, access to land, fertilizer, water, roads, credit, technical assistance, broadband. You wrote all those things. You also yeah. wrote about the availability of H-2B seasonal worker visas into this country and that that number should be greatly expanded. But I will note to your last answer that you said, more important, the United States needs to break a pattern in which foreign assistance is channeled through government contractors with too little transparency. And so there's the good governance piece, right? A lot of it when the government down there is controlling it, and maybe it's not a democratic system in the way we might like, the money isn't even going where it's needed.
Yeah, I think that that absolutely. I mean, there are two problems that you mentioned here. One is the fact that the government of Guatemala and our focus on combating corruption, et cetera, needs to expand from addressing corruption in the judicial sphere to addressing corruption when it comes to the allocation of resources across the board. So the government drains sort of the coffers of the development ministries, the Ministry of Agriculture, the Ministry of Transportation, into their own projects and into their own pockets. They line their pockets with the minimal funds that are available. So that's one problem that we have. The second problem is that the way in which development aid is dispersed is through development contractors, sort of U.S. development contractors, who take a large overhead, who design projects that don't necessarily reflect or rarely reflect community needs and priorities. And so they end up sort of making little difference and securing little local buy-in. And so these are two distinct problems and challenges that the U.S. faces as it seeks to address the root economic causes of migration in Guatemala.
Professor Isaacs, you describe the migrants coming from Guatemala as largely fleeing the desperate conditions in the rural highlands. That sounds like it's so different than anything they'll encounter here in the United States if they get resettled in Dallas or New York or, you know, even agricultural contexts in the United States. Is that a problem?
Yeah, I mean, it's an overwhelming challenge for all migrants coming from remote areas of Central America that land in Dallas, New York, Los Angeles, et cetera. I think it's a double challenge for many indigenous rural Guatemalans who are representing an increasing larger share of the migrants from Guatemala, because it's not only that they're coming from these remote areas, but they don't even, many of them, speak Spanish. They're primarily, their first and sort of major language is an indigenous language. Uh-huh. And so they have this additional challenge on top of the others.
So what do they find here? Or what's the challenge? What's the route to settling here for them and for our government if we are admitting them for asylum in relatively large numbers?
I think we need to distinguish between sort of asylum and sort of economic migration, because many of them are not seeking asylum. But the focus of this article really and is that there are things that we can do in Guatemala, and there are things that we can do through seasonal worker visas that bypass the need to for undocumented migration.
Right.
And that's where our emphasis should be. When they come here, many of them come to settled communities where they have relatives, et cetera, that can give them a place to stay, can give them access to a job. And it often takes very little time for them to arrive, turn around, and be very hard at work. But I think that really we have an opportunity in the Guatemalan case in particular, yes, because of what I say, to make a difference that sort of diminishes the need for undocumented migration.
Yeah, I'm glad you made that point about family ties, which makes all the difference so often for easy integration into life here. And I'm going to tack on one other question just about the timeline of all this, what you're talking about, what Vice President Harris and President Biden are talking about, solving the push to come to this country by fixing issues down there. I heard one of the guests on MSNBC this morning, sympathetic to the migrants, but with a view on foreign policy, saying it's going to take 20 years. How long is it going to take?
I mean, if we keep saying it's going to take 20 years, then it will always, there will always be 20 years ahead of us. So it's time to get started, is what I would say. Yeah, I mean, the problems are deep-seated. They're deep-rooted. They require a comprehensive solution. But if we continue sort of, you know, kicking the ball down the road, they'll always be 20 years ahead of us. So I say, let's get started. And the other thing I say is, let's focus on these seasonal worker visas. And so we have some alternatives right now that we could introduce that alleviate the pressures to, you know, take this expensive, unsafe journey and to arrive here and to live in these awful conditions as an undocumented migrant.
Anita Isaacs is a professor of political science at Haverford College and co-director of Migration Encounters, a Mexican Migrants Oral History Project. She co-wrote this op-ed with Jorge Morales Toy, a Maya Keiichi leader and human rights lawyer and specialist in rural agricultural development in Guatemala. The New York Times op-ed is called "Guatemala is America's Best Chance to Fix the Immigration Problem." Thank you so much for sharing all your thoughts with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.